This is Speaking of Anthropology here on KSUA 91.5 FM Fairbanks. My name is Kevin.
And my name is Dylan. And we are back for another episode here on a wonderful Friday morning, not Saturday afternoon as it used to be and as I got used to saying, but Friday morning. Speaking of Anthropology for the 28th of May, 2021. So how are you doing, Kevin?
I'm doing great. It's Friday afternoon, end of the week. Can't ask for anything better. Enjoying my summer here in Fairbanks, Alaska. Realizing that pollen is a friend and a foe at the same time. Because, you know, as you can see outside, it's very beautiful and green. But yet, all of the pollen flows in the air and makes my nose just a slight bit itchy. So I apologize for this stuffy nose Kevin version here on KSUA today. But doing quite well. How about you, Dylan? How are things down in the PNW?
Oh, they're going. You know, it's been a rainy for the past few days. But, you know, it's alternating a couple days rainy, a couple days sunny, which is nice. I haven't been too bothered by it. But you apologize. But also, you know, you are just being authentic to the interior of Alaska Fairbanks, you know, of a lot of that pollen, you know, especially the birch pollen, right, that just coats everything like a fine dust, you know. So that's as it goes. I was fortunate enough growing up in Fairbanks that there were only, I can only remember like maybe a particular year or two where it was bad enough that it affected me. But yeah, you know, those are the joys of summer in Alaska. But I am curious, because you have gotten to experience some of the other joys of summer in Alaska and some other joys in general. So what have you been doing so far for almost the month now that you've been getting to enjoy your post spring semester break?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Believe it or not, Dylan, we're coworkers. That's what we've been doing. So Dylan and I actually, alongside doing this Speaking of Anthropology radio show, we're also two museum staff members, I would call, museum employees.
Temporary staff,
working for the archaeology lab at the University of Alaska Museum of the North. Primarily working on artifacts in the collections, and you know, for me personally, it's at the museum, working with the archives and the old database that I'm currently just today trying to figure out with Dylan and with you know, one of the staff members in the collections, Scott, and realizing that it's not very easy yet. It can be very rewarding at the end of the day. And so that's the museum gig. That's been really interesting. I think that's something we should definitely chat about today. But beyond that, Dylan, I mean, summer activities, what else can you ask for? Frolicking about on the grass fields, because there's finally grass fields. I actually went mountain biking, or I think you would call it mountain biking, trail biking out here at UAF and the trails in the back. Quite boggy and quite muddy at some parts, and your bike just gets stuck, and then you make a mistake of stepping into it because you have to balance yourself, and then you walk around with muddy wet shoes, which is not bad. I mean, it's very satisfying in the summer, I guess. But mountain biking has been one cool experience, and of course I don't know if you've ever played this game before, but Spikeball. I'm not sure if you heard of this, Dylan, but it's like a circular trampoline on the ground, small, and you bounce like a volleyball, like a mini volleyball off of it, and you play essentially volleyball with a trampoline. I've been doing that with friends and learning about that and realizing, wow, summertime is all about outdoor activities, enjoying the weather. Not winter where you just stay inside and have a hot cup of tea and enjoy your readings, because it's so different. You still can't do that, but it's not as satisfying as being outdoors. And then I guess, sorry, my final note, I'm monologuing now too, but wow, the sun never sets. Okay, I paused there dramatically because the sun never sets in Fairbanks, Alaska. I mean, I'm up at like, what, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, outside playing sports or running about or going out for evening walk, and it's midnight. It's almost midnight, and it's still sunny and bright outside, and I am very confused. So to all of you out there who are confused like me, I understand. To those of you who've lived here long enough, well, I don't know how you do it, but it's really great.
Yeah, I mean, there is a reason they call it the midnight sun. I find your confusion kind of interesting, though. You know, I guess this is part of blinders, right? But obviously for you growing up, that wasn't a normal way for summer to be. Whereas for me, like, I've spent portions of summer a fair amount now outside of Alaska and outside of Fairbanks. But to me, generally, like, the prototypical, like, summer that I expect is one where the sun just doesn't set for most of it, you know, because that's what it was like growing up, right? And especially as we rapidly approach the solstice, now less than a month away, you know, and you're looking at it's at the point now where technically, you know, they'll say, oh, sun sets at, like, I don't know, 23:30, and sunrise is at 3:30, but really well, you just end up with a period of civil twilight, right? You know, so yeah, even when it supposedly is set, the sun is not fully gone, and it really is nice. But yeah, sort of something you've touched on is the differences in activities and stuff, right, between winter and summertime. And a lot of people will argue, and a lot of folks in Fairbanks would argue, that the only way the winters are bearable is if you get outdoors, right? You know, for them, if they were to stay cooped up inside all winter, then they wouldn't live in Fairbanks, because that would be, you know, they just couldn't do it. But then for others, you know, wintertime activities aren't really their cup of tea. Their cup of tea is a literal cup of tea, like you said, sitting indoors, reading a book, you know. And so, but then of course you then have a lot of those same folks are then the ones who are also very active as well in summertime. Of course you have people who do both, you know, are constantly outdoors, summer and winter alike, you know. But yeah, you know, as you've kind of brought up, there is some differences between how folks approach it, for sure, even in Fairbanks, you know, and of course in Alaska in general, and in the circumpolar north, I would also argue, you know, you get quite a diverse range of folks, and of course the wonderful summertime activities, right, you know, as well as the ones that will be coming later, you know, in June and stuff, right, with in July with like golden days, you know, and the midnight sun run, the baseball game, you know, the solstice baseball game, you know, all sorts of fun activities in summertime, for sure, that just definitely are not necessarily common or the, you know, typically found across the world, you know, playing baseball during what's essentially daylight, but at, you know, 10, 11 o'clock at night, you know. So I look forward to hearing more of your reports about all the fun activities that you're able to get up to as you finally enjoy a Fairbanks summer for the first time, which still just kind of boggles my mind that you did.
It's crazy, right? I think summer also is like just a different period. I think we've said this in previous shows, but congratulations to the grads who finally finished their degrees. and then you realize, wow, it's summer. So yeah, but yeah, it is mind-boggling. But I am curious, Dylan, for you, what it is like, you know, what summer activities as well as that you do might be very similar to what you do here in Fairbanks, Alaska. But I will also wonder, like, why, you know, yes, seasonally there's a change in temperature and weather, but what makes summer so special? You know, like, I think traditionally this is interesting because, right, in the United States we have, you know, school up till, like, I don't know, like, let's say May, right, which is then we have June, July for summer, 2 months of summer. Summer break, you know, you have the whole family takes time off to go on a vacation, and then we lock in for the fall and the winter seasons, and then in the spring again, and then we prepare for summer again, for vacations again. It's this cyclical year in, year out, and then of course you have like spring break and other holidays scattered throughout the year. But you know, summer, right? And I think about this because I say in the United States we have that summer break, right, the 2 month break. But then, you know, places like Germany where we both studied abroad, it was different because you had summer being the semester, summer semester, which many people do take classes as well here in the United States. But the tradition of that has changed because I think their break starts later in towards the winter season or winter holiday and into the spring, which is very different to me. It makes, our traditional thought or our stereotypical idea of summer is thinking, okay, summertime, it's nice outside, go enjoy it. Rather than, when I was in Germany, when we studied abroad, I was indoors all summer or most of the time studying in the library, which can be helpful too, because I think it's too hot outside sometimes. But I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong, Dylan, but what are your thoughts on this?
No, you bring up a good point because, yeah, like for the academic calendar and stuff, Germany is an example of a country that does work differently. But on the other hand, too, you also have countries that I would argue are even more, maybe we'll make this into a thing, you know, pro-summer, right? So, for example, here in the States, right, as you said, you know, in Fairbanks, for example, you are, have a summer break as a student lasting from May to about the end of August, depending on, the breaks can start or end about, I think, a week to 2 weeks offset, depending on whether you are in, K-12 versus at UAF. But yeah, you know, that's sort of the typical summer break. But then when you're working, obviously, you don't get, like, not a lot of folks are just taking, like, you know, 3 whole months off of their jobs entirely, right? Especially for students, for a lot of students, summer is when they work, right? You work in as many hours as you can over the summer to pay, you know, for your schooling. I met a fair amount of folks at UAF who do that, you know. But then you have a country like Sweden, for example, where nationwide students, as far as I understand it, but all it's famous for in workplaces for employees and stuff, like workers and everyone, they take, I believe, about the entire month of July off, right? And so the entire country is just like has a month-long summer vacation in July, right? It's not limited, you know, to just, school-age children or whatnot, right? And so, you know, that's not something that we do really in the States, right? Plenty of people will take vacations over the summertime, but, it's not like the, you know, all however many people are in the workforce here, what, like 250 million of us just take an entire month off. So, you know, there's definitely contrasting attitudes towards it for sure. Although, you know, maybe one can make the argument that because Sweden is even farther north than Germany and does have the longer winters, right, that are more comparable to a Fairbanks style winter, especially in the far north of Sweden, you know, that maybe that influences their attitude because they, like Alaskans, like a lot of Alaskans have come to prize sunlight more versus maybe, you know, in Germany where, yes, they have winters, but, you know, it's not maybe quite as extreme. It's a little less of a important commodity. But, you know, that's like a very environmental determinist explanation, right? Whereas, you know, politics, labor laws, just general labor culture, I think, is probably more where the answer for that difference lies. But yeah, you know, there's all kinds of differences. Or even in Japan, I think, right? Like, they get their summer break, I think, is what, like 3 weeks or a month long that they get off between semesters, and because school is essentially almost like a full year thing for them there, right? So, you know, the attitudes towards it are definitely different. And then, of course, you have the very concrete geographic differences of us in the Northern Hemisphere versus folks in the Southern Hemisphere, where their seasons are, you know, at entirely different times of the year, right? So Australia gets to celebrate Christmas in their summertime and such. So yeah, you know, it definitely all kinds of interesting factors that are going into it for sure in shaping those kinds of differences. But yeah, it's nice to get to see how Alaskans celebrate the summer, I would imagine, for you as an anthropologist, as someone who now has a whole degree in anthropology, right?
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, yeah, you know, you got me thinking too, Dylan, and I think we've spoken about this before in previous shows. By the way, today's show is just a chit chat of Dylan and I. The special guest is Dylan. The special guest is Kevin, chatting about our personal experiences here on KCUA 91.5 FM Fairbanks. But New Year's, I think about New Year's, like in Asia, the students have a break, and it's usually during the Asian, you know, you say Asian population or Asian like holidays, Chinese year, Korean, they have their New Year celebrations, Japanese, they have New Year celebrations, a variety, you know, Thai, Indonesian, Malaysian, right? There's all sorts. And, you know, of course, there's like, you know, these practices in the New Year's, but they always take like, you know, the equivalent, I think around like a month and a half to 2 months, depending on where you're working, where you're going to school, break, where you're just spending time with family, celebrating every day, attending local, you know, events and activities to celebrate the new year. Food, lots of food is eaten, lots of food is cooked. You know, the you know, the big, at least in Chinese culture, you know, being ABC and American born Chinese myself, you know, the good luck things, luck is important, very, very important. And I almost think I will say there's like a lot of similarities, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dylan, here, but I've noticed, like, especially here in Fairbanks, like the sun in the summer is extremely beneficial for, number one, gardening, right? That's a big thing, agriculture. And I've noticed, like, it's something that it's a switch that turns on in every Fairbanksian that says, okay, now it's time to go garden. And I love it because, you know, a few of my friends are doing it currently. And just that change and that need to get it out quickly and before the sun comes, and have everything set up, you know, grid lining their garden plots. Some people don't grid line, but I mean, it's okay. That's another debate for another time. But, you know, ensuring where your stuff is. And then secondly, of course, as we mentioned, going outdoors and doing sports and activities. But yeah, it's just, to me, it's interesting, this need and this want to adapt to this sun, extreme sunlight. I've also spoken to some of my friends who've mentioned, and they've read up on this too, and it's describing too much sun or too little sun can also be, you know, a health, you know, you could be deprived of darkness per se in the summer, right? You know, the store is now selling blackout curtains. You know, that's a thing that I didn't really realize till I got here. Likewise with happy lights, before that as well, in vitamin D. But yeah, anyways, what I was trying to get at here is the similarity between, you know, oh, okay, there's certain things that you should do traditionally, and there's certain things that you can explore upon. But I think I'm just too excited and too elated to see what's happening around me. And there's still so much more I have yet to see. And maybe what Dylan has seen, I don't know. But anyways, Dale, I was going to ask you if to follow up a little bit, but what's summer like for you so far down in the Pacific Northwest?
The Pacific?
Pacific Northwest, that's right.
The peaceful, tranquil Northwest. It's been nice. I mean, I've been mostly working this month, but actually the middle of next month, you know, we're going to be doing a bit of a family reunion and stuff. So, you know, some of those traditional summertime activities, you know, get to hang out with family, you know, that sort of thing. But yeah, you know, one of the things that I've noticed here that seems to be pretty popular, you know, for summertime stuff, and maybe one could argue year round, but I think summer is probably the best time to do it, is to go out to the Oregon coast, right? There's so many little beachside towns and stuff. You know, the big popular one that's probably about, I don't know, maybe an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours ish, if from where I'm at right now, is Seaside, Oregon, right? So, you know, that's a pretty common one in a way. Obviously, that in Fairbanks, you know, people do travel around the state quite a bit in summertime. But if you get in your car and drive 2 hours, you can find waterfront, but it's not oceanfront, right? You know, that's you know, you're going at Tichina Lakes or somewhere, you know, which is also, you know, quite fun. But that's the emphasis on, you know, getting out of town for a few days and going to the ocean side, right, is definitely a thing here. And especially, you know, when it's in summertime, you know, it's a little warmer down by the water and stuff, you know, and so it can maybe be a good way to cool off, or at least, you know, it's a little nicer than if you go in December and you start freezing, you know. But yeah, that's kind of something that I've noticed. But yeah, you know, it's interesting how many similarities there are really between like what are the popular activities here as compared with in Fairbanks, because a lot of it really is like, you know, going out and going hiking, you know, both in summer and then in winter, the skiing and stuff, you know, going out and camping and all that. And so, you know, that's pretty similar, really. Oregon and Washington, much like Alaska, have ample opportunities to do those activities that people take, you know, full advantage of. Although, of course, you know, with us still being in a bit of a pandemic, that's, you know, still a little variable, all the summertime activities. But yeah, you know, it's interesting. The agriculture thing, though, in Fairbanks is definitely real, right? I mean, there's so many farms and CSAs like Calypso and, you know, places to do like outdoors and agriculture, even oriented summer camps, right? I don't know if they still do them. I mean, maybe not with the pandemic, but even, you know, in the last few years, I don't know. But like there used to be summer camps at Creamer's Field and stuff that were oriented towards teaching kids about nature and the environment there and stuff, you know. And then of course a lot of the CSAs, some of the farms, you know, do things. So yeah, you know, there's both a lot of agriculture and a lot of those you know, the farmers market, the weekend farmers markets all over the place too, actually a fair amount, really, you know, ones on and off downtown and you know, the fairgrounds, all kinds of things there, you know, Southside Market. Yeah, so you know, there's a lot in that respect. And of course, you know, Fairbanks both has the agricultural community, but also a lot of what I think folks would broadly consider to be hobby farming, right? So, you know, people who primarily do other things but also on the side have gardens, raise chickens, sheep, goats, which, you know, is what my family did in Fairbanks for several years, you know. So yeah, it's definitely, it's a big part of summer for a lot of people, for sure. Is for a lot of folks, summer means, hey, it's time to go outside and garden, you know, or which again is, you know, the diversity of activities, right? For some folks, Summer means time to go out and fish. For others, it's time to go out and garden, or, you know, time to go out and bike the trails behind UAF, go to Angel Rocks. You know, there's quite the diversity of activities for sure for folks. Or even, you know, like I said, just going down to Chena Lakes or whatever, you know, go camping, just hang out by the lakefront, you know, a full spectrum for sure. So yeah,
the full spectrum of everything and anything that you can do. Dylan, I think it's time that we roll out some music, some good old music for our listeners. How's that sound to you?
It sounds good to me, Kevin.
So this is KSUA 91.5 FM Fairbanks. You're listening to Speaking of Anthropology on KSUA. And we have some music picks for you coming up right here. Enjoy.
This is Speaking of Anthropology here in KSUA 91.5 FM Fairbanks. And for today's episode, Kevin and I are just chilling, chatting a little bit about summertime, you know, and what that looks like in Fairbanks, a little bit around the world. And, you know, I kind of wanted to circle back to something that you'd brought up earlier, Kevin, about, you know, the other types of festivals, right? You know, and I think that's one of the fascinating things when you do that sort of comparative cultural anthropology, maybe, right, of where you look at, you know, not everybody has holidays around the world at the same time, right? You know, some you know, New Year's obviously is something that is changes quite a bit based on, you know, when your calendar starts and ends, right, which isn't the same globally. You know, summer can be emphasized or downplayed, you know, agricultural festivals can be the same, but everybody has holidays. Nobody doesn't have holidays, right? There's not many absolutes really in cultural anthropology, but I would venture that you can be pretty safe in saying that, like, holidays, however defined, whatever they are, whenever they occur, however they're celebrated, holidays are a very common feature of human societies, you know. And yeah, summer in a way can definitely feel like one big one really in Fairbanks for sure. But yeah, you know, even in that though, there are the specific ones, right? Again, as I mentioned before, you know, you have Golden Days, right, which celebrates, you know, the history of Fairbanks and more contemporary history of Fairbanks, right? It's emphasizing on the gold rush and, you know, when Felix Pedroni arrived in Fairbanks and that sort of thing. So, you know, you have literal holidays in it, but then that whole overarching summer that in a way can sometimes feel like one giant Fairbanksian holiday, right, Kevin?
Summer again. Yeah, no, what is Fairbanks known for? Being the Golden Heart city of Alaska, right, Dylan? Actually, this is kind of funny. I did a drive up from Anchorage to and fro, actually, with a friend this past weekend. And, you know, it was interesting because I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but there are a lot of cities that say they're the heart of Alaska. So I cannot truly figure out which one is the heart of Alaska. But Fairbanks is kind of far enough north and far enough if you compare Fairbanks this state of Alaska to a human organism. The heart is in the middle on the upper, you know, sides. I think that's where it is. But anyways, speaking of hearts and speaking of our passions, I think, you know, want to revisit kind of what it's like to work at a museum, I think, in summer jobs and summer gigs. I often think a lot about, I think, summer gigs or summer opportunities to be a learning experience for young people, you know, for both Dylan and I. It's working at the museum, right? Some people may, I know we have friends of the show, you know, who've been on our show, who work at, you know, tour boat companies. We have friends who, you know, will work at or Dylan will work at a movie theater as previous experiences. You know, and I know as Dylan looks off into the horizon, thinking about the past and the present and the future all in one. But, you know, the current times, at least for us both working at the museum, it's a unique opportunity. I think when you think about working at a museum, you think a lot about curatorial work, right? And what is being displayed. And then I guess the second big part, and I think this never clicked to me initially, I think as a young child, but a museum also holds a lot of important historically significant artifacts, pieces to be shown. You know, museums can range, I think, as well. Museums can have, you know, what we traditionally call art to contemporary art, to artifacts, to historical exhibits. Here at the museum now, Museum of the North now, there's a whole bowhead whale that's being suspended in the lobby and soon up into the air, suspended in, with above you in the lobby. So I think a variety of things. But I don't know what your thoughts are on this, Dylan. I know you've worked at the museum much longer than I have. But what is this museum experience like to you? And then, of course, then to become an employee of the museum, what is that like to you as well?
As you said, it's very educational, right? It definitely, you know, I would argue that at least half of many museums' mission is, you know, pertains to the collections that they manage that are entirely outside of the public eye, right? Much of it, you know, is not public facing. And of course, you know, you can argue about, you know, the importance of public facing work with regards to revenue streams and that sort of thing. But generally, you know, as is the case with the UA Museum of the North, what you see as a public visitor, you know, in the galleries on the main floor and the first floor, you know, the upstairs art level, you know, near where the bowhead whale is being suspended, you know, that is not the entire story of the museum or of what is located there. And yeah, you know, getting a sense of appreciation for that and of the work that goes on in a museum that is not just necessarily dedicated to showing and displaying things, but to, you know, to continuously doing research, right? A museum as a place where research is being continuously done and not just where things that have been researched are presented, you know, after the fact, right? And so getting to see that and being, you know, involved to an extent in that process, right? In the ways that we are, even though, you know, neither Kevin or I are necessarily doing research ourselves there, at least not right now, you know, part of that, you know, the inventorying, the helping to ensure that the collections at a museum, you know, are accounted for, or cataloged, or mapped, you know, is also part of that, so that folks later down the line who are curious about it, and a lot of students, right, at UAF and globally even, are able to then work with those collections to do research on them, you know, even after they have been brought to the museum, right? Of you know, in my time as an undergrad at UAF, I got to attend a couple master's thesis defenses and you know, PhD related stuff as well, and more than a few folks, you know, do work in the course of their masters at UAF with museum collections and stuff, right? And even you know, some of it I remember I was attending one and I was like, oh hey, after that, after one particular student was done with their research, I had actually been working myself on cataloging some of the collection that they had been working with in their pursuit of their master's thesis, you know. So it's definitely, you know, folks come back and use it, even, you know, because the process for a lot of the artifacts, at least in the archaeological collection, and, you know, actually similar ways but different methods with most everything else that's there, is that, you know, it is retrieved from the field. So it is dug in an archaeological dig. It is preliminarily analyzed, and then if it's deemed, if it's necessary to transport it back to the museum, then that takes place, right? And so then it gets put into the collections there, and then it ends up getting cataloged by people like Kevin or I. At some point, it gets put into a database, and then folks come along, maybe immediately after it arrives at the museum, maybe at some point later, depending on research interests and funding and all that. And folks work with those collections, right? And analyze them further, and so so that part is kind of the continuing research bit, right? And so even as someone who isn't really directly involved with it, it still has been something that I've gotten to see firsthand at the museum, and is definitely something that is really cool to see. And again, it's kind of a demonstration, right, of the multitude of things that go into anthropology, right? As I and many others, people in the field, have said before on the show, archaeology is not just limited to pulling something out of the ground and then, that's that, right? And it serves as a good demonstration of that kind of post-fact laboratory analysis and the cataloging and the recording and the collections management that goes into all that, making sure that these artifacts are, well maintained, are in good condition, and through all kinds of ways that is managed, if small things like acid-free bags to large things like a good HVAC system and all that, just all the multitude of stuff that goes into that whole entire museum process, right? And to get to see that firsthand and to then get to be able, to talk about it a little bit is definitely something that I have really enjoyed in getting in through both my 2.5 years of working at the museum now, as well as, of course, volunteering there for 8 years, I want to say, before then, ish.
Museum somewhere expert. There.
No. Right here. No, not at all.
To our listeners, you are listening to a museum expert.
No, not at all. I have gotten to see a decent amount at the museum by now. Not all there is to see, nor do I know all there is to know about it. We have been lucky enough to speak, for example, with the curator of the archaeology collection, Dr. Josh Ruther, a couple episodes ago, I think back in February of this year, I want to say, we've also gotten to talk a little more about that with those kind of folks. But yeah, it's just interesting to get to see how the cheese is made, so to speak, especially as someone who did grow up, I think like maybe a fair amount of folks in the field and in the social sciences going to museums as a kid and enjoying them and, going to all these places and, having a lot of fun there, and then getting to sort of see some of the behind the scenes, and even, I guess, being part of the behind the scenes, right, and working at one, it's definitely a interesting and informative job for sure, even if maybe as a cultural anthropologist I don't know that I'm going to be going into museum studies. But I think again, part of that having a broad field that we do, and part of anthropology, right, is being able to be a little maybe well-rounded in the various aspects of anthropology, even when not necessarily directly applicable to your research interests either. So I think that has been another nice thing about it for sure.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that, Dylan, and I give you commend you on all those years of experience, because I think about it within science communication, which is a really big part of current curriculum for university students and high school students and beyond, professionals in the field as well. Science communication is very important in getting across a message of what you are researching and what you are trying to find out about, right? And as you can see, I think with a museum, right, being able to create a display that, maybe this is one of Kevin's funny segments again, but, how would you curate a display, right? You got to, I think there are a few things you got to think about, right? You know, think about the age range of people that will visit, right? You know, how much content do you want to be able to put on? How do you summarize a whole entire thesis or a research paper into a panel board? And then of course the artifact or some sort of interactive, you know, display. How do you do that, right? And I think these are questions curators will probably ask and have asked, and we've spoken to, you know, Josh Ruther about it, Dr. Josh Ruther, and likewise, up and coming here in UAF, right? The hype around the museum bus 142 that's arrived, right? That too is big, you know. How, and we spoke with Dr. Ruther about this, about like, you know, who are the relevant actors that we need to speak to? Who are the relevant people that need to be involved within this project? How do we get, you know, even proper funding, right, to build the display, right? These are all different components and facets, I think, into museum anthropology. But, you know, and I think a little bit about this because, you know, at a museum, you know, example, the Museum of the North, both you and I have spent time there now. There's different departments, right? We have entomology, archaeology, ethnology, all the ologies in the museum, each of them working together to create a beautiful space for people to visit and learn about where they are and what has been there, right? And I think there's, this is a shout out, I guess, to the museum, but there's a great display there right now, I believe. Of course there's many, but I'll just summarize it saying like each of them have historical information from the ethnology department, maybe an artifact from the archaeology department, and so on and so forth. And each of them provide a little bit of information that can spark a numerous number of questions, and I think you're right, Dylan. Maybe now I think about it, Dylan. Maybe all anthropologists, if not most of them, went to a museum at some point in their lives and said, "Yeah, this is what I'm going to do. You know, I want to be a museum curator. I want to, or if not a curator." Go do research and then have your stuff be archived in a museum one day so that it can become a display. But I don't know. Maybe that's what the truth is about it. Of course, there are, you know, many debates on whether or not museums, I think we talk about post-colonialism, right? And the museums, you know, having, you know, a display, a show of things. Of course, that concept is changing now with the current museum directors and museum, you know, funds programs that are being, you know, made for to make things available for people to see. But I think these concepts are definitely changing. But on a positive note, I mean, museums are good spaces for kids to visit, school groups to visit, and, you know, potentially cultivate two anthropologists like Dylan and I, right? So, and anything to add, Dylan, about what I've been mentioning so far?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just kind of to both your beginning point and the point you're making towards the end, right? One of the things in curation collection, and I'm just speaking as someone who, enjoys visiting museums and, not as somebody who is who does that sort of public facing, like here's how to present a collection or anything like that. But just as a museum enthusiast, maybe not a professional, I would say that one of the foundational thing is you have to think about why you're presenting something, right? What are you trying to communicate by presenting something, right? Because despite what maybe people who don't like museums feel like, they're not just, or at least in good design, I don't think they should be places where you just show people a bunch of things and are like, yeah, we just found like 10,000 arrowheads. So this is what 10,000 arrowheads looks like. Like that's not, you're not really like conveying anything besides, I guess, that you can dig 10,000 arrowheads out of the ground, you know, that's not really like anything being conveyed, right? Whereas like good public collection design, you know, you're displaying something because you're conveying something, you're explaining something, you're telling something, right? I would say telling a story, although in kind of the original sense of something that has happened, not just something that, you know, is fiction, but, you know, you're telling something that has happened, right? Or, you know, even increasingly, maybe you are both telling something that has happened while challenging or encouraging the patron of the museum, the person visiting and viewing, to reflect not just about the past, but about things that are contemporary, you know, experiences that are still happening, you know, about the connection between both the past and the lived present, right? And not just demonstrating, you know, like, yeah, you know, 2000 years ago, people carved this out of ivory, right? And that's interesting, sure, but you can also make connections as well to the present, you know, and so I think that that's something that is maybe increasingly being utilized by museum designers, maybe, for lack of a precise phrase on that. But yeah, you know, there's a lot that that can go into it. There's a lot of views and methods that you can use in designing public facing collections and that sort of thing. And it's definitely interesting. And again, I'm just somebody who enjoys this stuff quite a bit. I'm not, you know, I don't do it recreationally or professionally, you know, but I've gone to a lot of museums and I've thought, you know, and talked with folks a fair amount about, like, you know, what works and what doesn't and why things are designed the way they are and maybe how things ought to be designed. And I think it's you know, definitely something. So, you know, for folks who are listening to the show, you know, next time you're in a museum, any museum, hopefully you go to more than one museum at some point, you know, in the future. But, you know, next time you're in a museum, you know, obviously, you know, pay attention to the artifacts and to, you know, what the museum is explaining to you. But also, you know, maybe stop and think a little bit about why it is being presented to you the way that it is, why it's laid out the way that it is, you know, what are the design decisions that went into it, and what are those design decisions trying to convey? Because I, you know, like anything else in our culture and in our society, museums are products of societies and cultures, and those kinds of decisions are made about them and do go into them, you know. And so you can analyze the design and intent of a museum, I think, in ways that you can, you know, in many of the same ways that you can analyze layouts of, you know, other public buildings or, you know, other sorts of public oriented ventures, right? And I think that it can be a interesting and worthwhile thing to do that with, you know, to contemplate those design decisions that go into museums, especially to, you know, if you think about some of the quite fancy museums in the world out there, there's been a lot of thought and a lot of money that have been poured into them, you know. So next time, you know, dear viewer, next time, or listener, dear listener, next time you're in a museum, you know, maybe stop and think a little bit about why it's laid out the way it is and how and why they're trying to present to you the things that they are in the way that they are.
Think about the museum. Think about the people in the museum, because we're anthropologists, right? You know, the flow of people, how long are they spending at an art piece, or how long they're spending at a specific display. Then you move it. Yeah, this is interesting too, Dylan. Cafes, you know, the number of people that are in there and eating the maybe slightly expensive food. And then, of course, the gift shops. I mean, you go into the gift shops and what is being sold there, right? Is it, you know, I it's kind of interesting. Also, I think I've come across this consistently, and I've seen in review videos and podcasts and people discussing. But you go into a gift shop, it's like you're buying a piece of the museum, because there's either a T-shirt printout of your favorite artifact, or a mug, or a I don't know, dartboard that you can buy, right? And all these, I think, just add up to it, to what it means to be a museum goer, right?
Yeah, on that note, I'll quickly say, I remember, I don't buy a lot of things when I'm in gift shops in general, because it's not really my thing. But when I was in Trier, in Germany, I went to the Landesmuseum there. And so, you know, it was about the whole history of folks living in the area, right? From like Celtic Hallstatt culture all the way up, you know, they had very nice like Roman late classical, early into early medieval coin collection, that sort of thing. But at the gift shop, I was wandering through it because I was curious to what they had. And I found it's a dictionary of archaeology related words and phrases, you know, all kinds of things, shovel, mound, tell, everything. It's, you know, decent sized, but it's a dictionary of it's sort of a dictionary of archaeological words and phrases, but with translations into 7 languages, so that you can, you know, in Greek, in Turkish, in Arabic, in English, German, Russian, you know, you can you know, if you're working in an international dig, if you find yourself at an international dig, you can use that. And like, what's the Turkish word for shovel, you know, or how do you talk about arrowheads in Arabic, you know? And so you could use that. And so I actually bought that because I thought that that was such an interesting little thing to have. But yeah, you know, the sorts of things that you find in a gift shop, right? As you said, maybe it's your favorite artifact, or maybe it's something that seems a little more inside baseball, a little more pertaining to archaeology, although probably sold as mostly a novelty item, you know? So yeah, you can find all kinds of interesting things, not just in museums, but in their gift shops as well.
It's a shop, and that's what they say, right? Shopping for new ideas, new experiences, and something to take home. That's what museums are all about. No, I'm joking. It's been a great show. It's been almost an hour of us just talking about museum experiences, and hopefully got you listeners thinking a lot about how you visit museums, and maybe you might want to be employed at a museum and become an anthropologist. A win-win for everybody. But Dylan, any final notes for our listeners today?
I hope everybody who is listening to Speaking Anthropology here on KSUA 91.5 FM Fairbanks has a wonderful weekend. And, you know, hope y'all tune in to our next episode on the 4th of June, 2021, same time, 11 a.m. to 12 p.m.
We'll be here on KSUA. See you guys later. Thank you.